There's a wonderful story about the rhinoceros that was brought back from the Indies to Spain, where it was an object of wonder. They brought it back, they fed it on fruit, because they didn't really know what it ate. And then the King of Spain, don't know whether he had a daughter or not, decided to give the rhinoceros to the Pope. And they set off on a sea journey again with this rhinoceros. But it was, I don't know whether you can say manacled, it was
Forticled
to the floor, and there was a storm and the ship sank and the poor rhinoceros. So there are lots of rhinoceros stories. I'm not going to talk this morning exclusively about rhinoceroses, but really the theme of the conference is, what's your story? And I thought when I was asked to do this, well, there's no more interesting story than the story of knowledge organisation itself. And I've had for some time a theme that LIS is particularly interesting because it's a discipline with a relatively short history. It really begins in a formal way at the end of the 19th century. So I know people, have known people who knew those people who were working at that time. And the chain of tradition is really very short. But actually, when you begin to go into it, the foundations of knowledge organisation go far, far further back in history. So my theme today is to look at some of those strands, those narrative strands, a kind of rich tapestry of the history of knowledge organisation in which there are themes and topics, motifs on the tapestry of it that are occur early in history and then are picked up again in the 20th century. And to some extent, there's a jump over what happened in the late 19th century to pick up on some of the philosophical and intellectual ideas. Now, another precursor to this is the idea of what you're doing when you build a classification or a knowledge organisation system. And this puzzled me a lot when I was the graduate tutor and I ran a seminar for the doctoral students. And I was the only person that was even remotely on the scientific and technical side. So I had a lot of digital humanists, a lot of archivists there, and they were all very contextual, very cultural oriented, very relativistic. And I felt I was on a twig on one side of the tree of life by myself. And I puzzled to fit myself into this kind of disciplinary structure of, say, information studies. And I puzzled and puzzled, and then it came to me in a light bulb moment that what I was doing was domain modelling. And the history of knowledge organisation, to a large extent, is the building of models. The building of models of information, of knowledge, models of the natural world, trying to understand what the world is like, trying to explain what the world is like through your model, which is, you know, generally what scientific models do. You try and make a pattern that will allow you not only to understand what's going on, but to discover undiscovered knowledge. So much of these early intellectual efforts are about mapping the knowledge you have to try and explain the world, but also to find out about the knowledge you don't have. And that's still part of what we're doing today. Now, these models are usually imperfect, and we'll look at some examples of imperfect models. But I'm always very taken by this quote from Borges, himself a librarian. You know, he's a famous national librarian who had actually been a library worker in his youth. So a lot of his writing is about libraries and uses library themes and motifs and so on. But he says, obviously, there is no classification of the universe that is not arbitrary and conjectural. The reason is very simple. We do not know what the universe is. So much of our work on the conceptual side of knowledge organisation is trying to work out what the universe is, how to find out about it, and how to build our model. So I'm going to look at some models and some themes of knowledge organisation quite quickly, really, because a brick will be thrown at me from the front row if I don't get on with it. I actually have to thank Leonard for this, Leonard Will, who in the famous ISCA UK event, we defended the idea of the thesaurus. And Leonard spoke about the naming of names with reference to the biblical period. So here is Adam naming the animals. And it's one of the first examples, first of naming concepts, of establishing control over the things that you name. And probably the first little inkle of vocabulary control. And you can say, Vanda, that's a bit far-fetched. But I have had a master's student who wrote about classification in the context of the naming of names in Genesis. But there's no end to the weirdness of things that students do, present students accepted. I did have here a very, very nice image of Noah's Ark, which I took out at the last moment. But you see, there is a great interweaving, a great network of themes here, because the one animal you... What's the one animal you always see on any depiction of Noah's Ark? The giraffe. So I was very pleased that you showed a giraffe. Never see... Hunt, you know, look at the Western tradition of art. You'll never see a Noah's Ark without a giraffe on it. But anyway, here we have the animals and Adam naming them, and some slightly weird animals here, animals that you might not expect to see, but in the medieval period, when this was in the medieval Greek world, when this was done, the model of the animal kingdom was imperfect. So there are some unlikely animals there. Can't see any unicorns though. Aristotle is the person that we perhaps think first introduced the idea of classification. So here's, these are all pinched off the internet, these things. Aristotle's classification, interestingly, animals that fly, animals that swim, animals that walk, run or crawl. Interestingly, if you look at folk taxonomies, of the animal taxonomies produced by particularly pre-literate societies or primitive societies, that's often the classification that they make, because their interest in animals is as dinner. So you need to know how catchable the animal is, whether it can walk, run, easily catchable, swim, a bit more tricky, fly, impossible, forget it, really, unless you've got a bow and arrow. But we've also got other characteristics here, blooded animals and bloodless animals, which is Aristotle's first division, and then egg-laying things, birds, fish, he's never quite sure where some things fit into this, but a whole variety of characteristics of animals that he uses to group them. And again, the first inkling of the kind of structures that we have in, particularly in faster classifications, of sorting into groups characterised by different attributes. And if we jump forward, this is Bliss's theory behind his classification of fauna, and you can see the same sort of thing. The kind of animal or plant here and the environment in the beginning, I think in Bliss, an early indication of facet analysis, but, you know, some centuries on from Aristotle. And interestingly, this is UDC animals, and again, we see the same grouping of animals according to different characteristics. So animals kept for breeding, animals kept for food, animals kept for work. So from those early Aristotelian things, we get some fundamental principles of classification. The most interesting period, I think, though, is from the medieval period into the early modern period, where people start to build models of the entire world of knowledge, and models that attempt to explain the world and allow you to interrogate the world. And probably one of the most famous is Ramon Llull. He was a Catalan monk, and he devised a thing called the Ars Magna, the Great Art, which attempted to explain the world. It's regarded by mathematicians as an early example of logic diagram of a computational aid. So in the 13th century, Raman Lull devising a system that will be recognised by 21st century mathematicians as an example of a computational thing. I've got masses of notes here, more than I can use. But interestingly, this is what Leibniz in the 17th century says about Raman Lull. He was much impressed by him. He says, Leibniz sees there the germ of a universal algebra by which all knowledge, including moral and metaphysical truth, can someday be brought within a single deductive system. And Martin Gardner, the mathematician, which was the source for this quote, he says, if controversies were to arise, there would be no need of disputation between two philosophers than between two accountants, because you could calculate from Raman Lull's system what was true and what wasn't true. And of course, Jeremy Bentham picked this up in the 19th century with his calculus of pleasures. You could always work out in a computational way what was the right thing to do. And here's Raman Lull, and Leibniz also said a really, really interesting thing: all concepts are nothing but combinations of a relatively small number of simple concepts, faceted classification, just as words are combination of letters. And it makes me wonder whether Ranganathan knew about. Ranganathan was a mathematician. He must have known about Leibniz. Did he know about this? Is this where he got the idea from? Possibly not. I've never seen it mentioned, but this is, you know, some 700 years before Ranganathan, a system that works on the same intellectual principle. So here is Leibniz in the 17th century commenting on Lull about the core nature of his system that we can recognise as a system that's not miles away from a faceted classification. And here are the philosophers disputing, but with benefit of the computational system. So you see, they're very calm in their disputation because they're going to arrive at the same end point in any case. Also, the references that it's a grammar to, the idea of a language, of the representation of thought through a language, an artificial language, a code of some sort, is a really another important feature. And this is the centre, the Contemporary Culture Centre in Barcelona, which of course is, so Lull will be one of their own. And they held an exhibition about Raman Lull called The Thinking Machine. It's interesting, so Lull's system is a thinking machine. And they say Lull sought to establish a complex model of reality that encompassed the world, humankind and God, particularly God, as if in a vast web. So there's a little chime. So this is not just a model, it's a thinking machine and it's a web. So here's a 21st century thinking machine. I puzzled about the citation order here, whether I should look at the thing and the thing in different periods, or whether I should go in a linear fashion, but we're never like a linear fashion. So here's a 21st century thinking machine. It's just a model, it's a visualization of an inference engine. And what was Lull's system but an inference engine? If you knew X and Y and Z, put them together, you can calculate Z1 that you at the moment you don't know. Of course, that's exactly what Mendeleev did with the periodic table. You hardly ever see a popular kind of general lecture on classification where somebody doesn't mention the periodic table, because to my mind it's a near perfect classification. It takes the attributes of the entities you have, it creates a model. And then it's, this is not very up to date, it stops at 117, so we have gone beyond this. What can we infer from that? It's an inference engine. We can say something about elements that we currently don't know anything about on the basis of the elements that we do know something about. So that's a beautiful model. Sometimes the model, however, is not right. Often models are not right. We build models on the basis of what we know, but sometimes we've not got it quite right. The planetary model of the solar system is like that, because there are now planets that we didn't. In Copernicus' time, there were planets that we didn't know about, so it was wrong in that respect. Then we found other planets, we put them in, so it's a bit righter than there. Now we've decided that some of that was wrong and we need to kick some of those planets out. So the model is always, to some extent, a simplification, so we can reject it if we need to. This is a model. I need to explain this, really. This is based on the idea of, well, the story, we assume true, of Marco Polo going to the Indies, seeing there a rhinoceros. And according to the taxonomies of the day, the bestiaries, an animal that you came across with, well, this is very Aristotelian, with four legs and one horn, that would be a unicorn, because that's with the definition of a unicorn. So they thought, oh, well, it must be you, well, we've discovered the unicorn. However, it did not really kind of meet their model of a unicorn, which it was known would lie calmly in the laps of virgins. And there's one calmly lying in the lap of a virgin. And the animal they saw did not look as if it might rest in the lap of a virgin without some damage to the virgin during the process. So I have to say, as far as I'm aware, they didn't test it, but it did cause them to test the model. So I thought, well, let's have a look at examples. There's a nice unicorn. Let's have a look at rhinoceros. This is the first rhinoceros I found, which actually didn't look all that threatening. It had a kind of rather Winnie the Pooh feel about it, as rhinoceroses go, in a kind of mildly dim and inquiring way. So I thought, I'll find another rhinoceros. This is Rosie, the Ipswich rhinoceros, who resides in the Ipswich Museum. But unfortunately, somebody decided to remove Rosie's horn at some point. They broke into the museum and took it away. So it's why she has a label saying replica on the horn. But it's a fairly fearsome horn, but still a rather kind of beneficent looking rhinoceros there. So, but that's the story. Where your model of the universe doesn't fit your evidence and you receive a culture shock as a result. And then there's a need to modify that model. So, moving on, as they say, moving on from the idea of those thinking machines, we come in the early modern period, a little bit later than Lull, to the idea of the theatre of ideas. It's very interesting that we are in a theatre here, because it has this same sort of fan-shaped model. These were linked to the idea of a theatre of memory, and they were aid memoir. They were ways of laying out knowledge. So again, they are thinking machines, they're memory machines, that if you can remember the structure here, you can recall things that you did know but had forgotten you knew. This is a really interesting one because it's built on seven pillars. It's extremely fanciful, this one. And I've got a list of the seven pillars here. The layer that rests on the seven pillars are variously called the banquet, the cave, the gorgons, pacify, that's P-A-S-I-P-H, not P-A-C, the sandals of Mercury and Prometheus. So it's all a bit mysterious, but there's an amazing book that some of you may have seen, and it's called Planet Narnia. Anybody seen that? Oh, it's just very weird in my taste. And it's a thesis written on C.S. Lewis, who of course was a medievalist, that said in writing the Narnia books he was influenced by this kind of model, and that there is this sevenfold planetary related model behind the Narnia stories. There were other examples here. Giordano Bruno, who's kind of a few decades on from Camillo, who invented the theatre of memory there. Again, an interrogation system. You can manipulate this thing. You can turn the wheels. You can compute information there. He uses every symbol name to man here, and I just thought, well, I was doing it. It's kind of redolent of the UDC. I expect people didn't like it very much at the time. They went, oh, I can't use this. It's all full of symbols that I'm unfamiliar with, and I don't know how they relate to each other. So I thought an example in the 21st century of what were called ars combinatoria, the combinatorial arts, things where you put your simple concepts together to get more complex ones, is of course the faceted classification. I'm sorry, this is a bit of bliss. This is a bit of chemistry in bliss that shows the building up of complex concepts here, chemicals, through the conjunction of these simple little bits of information. So from the Ars Combinatoria of the early modern period, the 14th and 15th century, or going back to Lull in the 13th century, we've got the equivalent in the 20th and 21st century, the same sort of principle. If you know the bits, you can not only work out the bits you don't know, but you can build up a more complex structure. And that sort of model, that theatrical model, then began to influence library practice. So in the Renaissance, there was an idea of how you would lay out a library that was also a model of the world. So Leibniz, right, it's Leibniz again, he was a librarian, Leibniz, among other things, and he wrote that a library should be the equivalent of an encyclopedia. And very often they were. The idea was that your library should represent the world. It should, the idea of a library as a representation of personal taste came much later on in the 18th and 19th century. So if you were a rich gentleman and you wanted a library in that period, it would conform to a standard of what you should. So it was a very static thing. It should represent the known world, and it might very often be supplemented by objects and artistic elements to support that view of the world. At the same time, you've got the development of museums and the Cabinet of Curiosities. There's a nice one. So the Kunstkammer, the Cabinet of Curiosities, again, that's regarded in the period as a microcosm or a theatre of the world and a memory of theatre. So it reminds you what you should know, and it's a representation. And this quote here says it also represents the patron's control of the world through its indoor microscopic reproduction. In your Cabinet of Curiosities, of course, you would always have one of these. It's a unicorn's horn. Everybody's got one. Where did they get them from? Not from rhinoceroses, obviously, from this chap. So this is the narwhal, but you know, then the idea of a narwhal was a bit confused, so they weren't really sure. I don't think the narwhal's horn was fixed onto its forehead in the manner of a unicorn, but it's probably, it comes out of its snout, doesn't it? So everybody had one. Now, what we also see in this period that's really interesting is the beginning of information organisation. So not just the organisation of objects in a library or a cabinet of curiosities or an early museum, not just the arranging of a collection, but the arrangement of your own stuff. See, Stella could have benefited from this with her messy and untidy desk. You need to know about this, because some of the devices that were put in place here demonstrate the origins of subject indexing, of subject headings, of metadata and search techniques, and the origins of something like a thesaurus. I was going not to mention the thesaurus, since I said not to mention the thesaurus, but there we are. What we see in that early period, some of you may know the wonderful book by Anne Blair, Canadian historian, said Too Much to Know, was a panic in the 16th and 17th century about how much everybody had to know and how impossibly messy and difficult it was to manage. So what was invented by several people simultaneously was this Arca Studiorum, the Ark of Studies, where you would sort out your notes, your bits and scraps of paper, and very often they would have a cabinet with lots of drawers and hooks and places to file away your notes in a systematic manner. Might be in a book, in a ledger, rather than a cabinet like this. But the cabinets were very... So we moved from the cabinet of curiosities to the cabinet of information. But Otley had one too at the beginning of the 20th century. So here's Otley's Mondo Tech, where you would have a multi-dimensional access to multimedia resources. I have Otley. Anybody who doesn't know Otley's drawings, just look, there are lots of examples on the web, and they're very cunning. It's the beginning of information science here with Otley, but how like that previous thing this is, and how we've jumped somehow from the 17th century to the 20th century and picked up that same idea. Here's Otley's other achievement, of course, is the world bibliography idea of making a bibliography of everything that ever been printed since the beginning of movable type. And of course, you put it in a cabinet like this, a catalogue. I don't think the catalogue was ever published, but the organisation system was published as universal decimal classification. So again, another cabinet of curiosities there, picking up on those themes. What they were also doing at the time, which is kind of more thesaurus related, was to look at things like subject headings and heading systems. And lots of people invented schemes for organising your notes and bits of paper. There are famous people, John Locke, in the Essay on Human Understanding, he had an index that showed the system he used for making notes. Bacon had one. It's for the process, the grand process of formularies and elegances. Right, going quickly now. And Milton. Milton's commonplace. Oh, that's Locke's commonplace book there. But many of them had these systems of headings. Well, this is just a brilliant one that I must tell you, because here's another Suffolk man, Robert Grosseteste, Robert Fathead, and he introduced an encoding system. He's actually very early. He's more a contemporary of Lull, but he's got this wonderful coding system. So it's an early retrieval device here. Here's a modern coding system, SCOS, Simple Knowledge Organisation System, doing the same sort of thing, taking your text, coding it so that you can then look for those features of things. And in that same, in the 17th century, you've got things like the artificial languages. Lots. Dr. Wilkins is the most famous one. You can look it up. Burgess has written an article, which is easily found online, The Analytical Language of Dr. John Wilkins. And it's highly structured. Artificial language. Latin's going out. How do you communicate scientifically? Well, you make an artificial language that everybody will use. It's a bit tricky, really. But it shows some considerable features of a faster classification. It's very simplified. The concepts are very simple. So he encodes using an alphabetic notation things like a priory is a college of monks. He puts those things together. A calf is a young cow. So a puppy is a young dog. And the coding for concept like young remains the same. I found an example, Foskett's London Education Classification, which also had a pronounceable notation, like Wilkins' language. So this was, I think it is still used at the Institute of Education, but probably not in this form. So Ranganathan had his, when we come into the 20th century, his three planes, the idea plane, the verbal plane, the notational plane. So Ranganathan said you must think about concepts, lexical labels and coding. And I just liked, I'm always looking for the Meccano inspiration, but here somebody has built a Meccano model of Babbage's difference engine. You know, what's not to like about this? So it all comes together there. But I really wanted to say a modern knowledge organisation conversation system exhibits all of these features that we've seen in these things from some centuries ago. Modelling, naming, hierarchy, organisation into arrays, analysis into simple concepts, combinatorial rules system, syntax, discovering undiscovered knowledge, encoding, organising and retrieving complex content, knowledge representation. So everything from those centuries ago. Now, because I said I would not mention the thesaurus, I thought I've ignored prehistory, so we better have this. And this is just closing. This is just because I like this. Of the many cartoons about thesauri, this is the best. It's not written in very easy language. So the top thing says, "Hi, everybody. Look out, it's one of those, you know, the approaching asteroid, one of those, you know, what's it called? The thing with the fire and stuff." And the caption is, "Despite its name, the thesaurus was quite often at a loss for words." Thank you. Could have said about 14,000 words.